Welcome to this podcast episode on liberal education systems. This very podcast is brought to you by the International Academy for Leadership. As you may know it under the acronym IAF, many people have attended who are probably listening to this podcast. The IAF is located in Germany in the town of Gummersbach, and it's a place where young liberals from all over the world train and discuss and exchange ideas about liberal policies. The idea is that together, through interactive sessions, they would discover new policy solutions to challenges of the day. And one of these IAF seminars have dealt with education systems. And the question was, what really is a liberal education system? This gave us the idea for this podcast episode to discuss the constituting principles of a liberal education system. What is it really? And we have decided in this podcast episode to cover a few of those that we found important. And that would include, obviously, an emphasis on individual freedom, which means a broad-based curriculum suitable to the context of the learners. The idea is to cultivate intellectual moral virtues, which is a through and through liberal principle that should be a part and parcel of a liberal education system. But that obviously is not enough. It would also have to somehow involve the private sector and would require that the schools are able to operate on a certain level of autonomy. And last but not least, it is of course important that parents are, and children obviously, are involved at a high level, meaning they do have their roles and their responsibilities to play in a liberal education system. With us today are renowned experts who have extensive experience in the area of education, and they are here and they are sharing with us their thoughts. My name is Rainer Heufers. I will be co-hosting this episode together with my friend and colleague, Apita Nepa.
Thank you, Rainer. Hello, everyone, and thank you for joining us in this very, very interesting conversation surrounding education, which has always been a subject of debate in the liberal world to the extent of we need, how much state involvement we want, how much of an autonomy should individuals have on deciding the kind of education system we have. We're delighted to introduce you today to today's guest speaker, Michael Strong. Michael is a highly experienced creator of small, innovative, and high-performance schools. His projects include the Moreno Valley High School, which was ranked the 36th best public high school in the U.S., Go School, a lab school based on entrepreneurship and intellectual development, with Winston Academy, a school at which middle school students pass advanced placement courses, and middle school programs for Heads Up, a multi-campus Montessori organization. One of Michael's innovations at his schools is Socratic practice, a form of text-based intellectual dialogue designed to increase verbal scores and increase intellectual sophistication. He's the author of The Habit of Thought, From Socratic Seminars to Socratic Practice, and has consulted for hundreds of schools and universities across the world. Michael is joining us from Austin, Texas today. Thank you very much for being with us, Michael. Welcome.
Thank you. I'm delighted to be here, Arpita.
And we're also happy to have a second speaker who is joining us from New Delhi in India. Parth Shah is the founder president of the Center for Civil Society and the founder of a national Independent School Alliance in India. It is a federation of 80,000 budget private schools in that country. He's also the co-founder and dean of the Indian School of Public Policy, which equips a new generation of policy leaders with skills to address the complex challenges facing India and the region. Parth's research and advocacy work focuses on choice and competition in education, where he requests funding to go to students and not to school. Very famous slogan, money should go to the students and not to the schools. He's also worked on property rights, good governance, and economic freedom, especially for the low-income segment of society. Parth has edited and published extensively in international and Indian journals on various issues ranging from currency regulation to education policy. He's a member of several state and national government task forces, including the Education Task Force for the governments of Delhi and Karnataka. He recently also joined the board of directors of the Atlas Network in the United States. But Parth, before we turn to you, let me address Michael first. We want to talk about different principles. And the first we want to address is actually the promotion of individual freedom and the autonomy of the individual that we see as a core element of the liberal education system. As I mentioned earlier, key principles at the core, we have this in the educational realm. That means actually self-directed learning, isn't it? and emphasizes student choice and responsibility in the education. So what we want is that schools help to foster critical thinking. We want the students to adopt a moral and intellectual autonomy. This should be a key concern, and that should be what is guiding us to make sure children learn to think and act independently. Yes, nothing can be a more liberal concept than that. Now, Michael, with your experience with an ideal place to foster such autonomy in individual schools, are schools even able to deliver this today? And are teachers equipped to deal with this? What would you say?
Well, very much so. I would say I've dedicated my life to creating schools exactly along the lines that you suggest. And first, I want to establish a different model of education. I think the standard educational model, which is pervasive around the world, has narrowed our understanding of what education can be. There's some Stanford scholars who talk about the grammar of schooling, where this is what you study in third grade. This is what you study in fourth grade. This is your history class. This is your science class. This is your math class. And to a shocking extent, from my perspective, something like this is the structure of government education systems pretty much around the world. So in order to really lean into how different education could be, I'm very interested in young entrepreneurs. And going way back, people such as Ben Franklin and Andrew Carnegie and Thomas Edison really all started their professional lives around 12 or 13. Now, in traditional societies, at puberty, often young people would start to work. And I think the reaction against child labor has gone too far in terms of reducing the extent to which we expect young people to take responsibility and initiative. There's a New York State Teacher of the Year, John Taylor Gatto, who describes traditional education, conventional education, as 13 years of training in how to be very passive and how to be dependent on other people. And so with respect to liberal principles, I think this global system of government-driven education around the world has trained now generations to be, obviously not everybody is passive and dependent, but I think relative to what could be, they are much more passive and dependent than they could be. So back to young people in my experience, I've spent most of the last 20 years of my life either in Silicon Valley or Austin, Texas. The old Silicon Valley, and Austin's becoming the new Silicon Valley. And there are many young people, again, at the age of 12 or 13, who start developing businesses. I'll give you a couple of examples. There's a student I mentored who started learning to code on Minecraft at the age of 8. By the time he was a teenager, he created a Minecraft mod company. He raised $1.2 million in venture capital at the age of 16. He went on to go to Stanford, but he might be selling a company for $20 million at the age of 20. To take a different example, another student, a current student who is working to bring influencers with 20 million, 40 million followers to gaming companies. I think people, older people, don't realize the extent to which gaming companies are becoming the new media companies, and they want to take advantage of those eyeballs and bring even more eyeballs. And so this student was offered $150,000 in salary as a 16-year-old. He turned it down for commission-based work, and he'll probably make $200,000 this year on commissions. I've got another student whose dad buys tax delinquent properties and resells it. And we helped his son create a part of the business where he hired 12 virtual assistants from around the world and then programmed some AI bots to look through all the tax delinquent properties in his state, identify which ones would be best for his dad to purchase. And then he gets a piece of that, and he'll probably make $200,000 at the age of 12 in his case. And I could go on and on. This is the world I live in, of hundreds of teens who are doing amazing things. On the creative side, I have a teenager who wrote a 200,000-word fan fiction novel, and she has 30,000 followers on a fan fiction website. I've got teens writing for a national publication. Actually, my school is working on a film about a young person who at 7 started his business breeding meat rabbits and selling them to restaurants. Then at 8, he managed to buy a 350-acre ranch because of the money he made from his meat rabbits, and he got into breeding meat coats. So he was just an extraordinary entrepreneur. And so I think we don't really know what young people are capable of, and we need a new educational system to get them there. One more point, and then I'll let you go to your next question. A lot of my students are in digital marketing, and digital marketing, you know, it's all about more eyeballs on websites. Almost every business wants more eyeballs on their website. So if people are good at digital marketing, they can bootstrap their way into making money. And often teens know more about, you know, TikTok and Instagram and Facebook and Twitter than older people do. So they can, you know, create businesses in digital marketing. Meanwhile, K-12 and even university education is pretty much worthless for these careers. There's an entire category of career that the system at all levels is failing to bring people into. One more data point, Mr. Beast hated school. At the age of 12, started optimizing for YouTube. He optimized both the video content as well as how to work the algorithms. He has now got about 180 million followers, more than an order of magnitude, more than the New York Times. And his business is worth $1 billion. He's in his 20s now. So I think a lot of people still believe in the old-fashioned school. And there's still, you know, a role for people when they get a PhD in math to do that standard track. But there are such incredible opportunities available outside of the system. And we need schools that focus on helping people get into these kinds of activities and careers in a way that traditional school is just completely failing young people in doing.
Thank you, Michael. That's such an interesting opener here, because that makes us discuss indeed the key issues of an education system. Because when I think about the standard test, you know, we have PISA and all the other ones, and usually you have the East Asian systems that are quite leading in these outputs and these test results. But these kids over there, they basically work like 16 hours a day. They go to school, they have tuition offers, they have almost no time to play or do anything else rather than learn. So if you would burden them with an entrepreneurship on top of that, they probably would collapse, I would dare say. So I think you're talking about an entirely different approach to education. Where to start? You have so much practical school experience. Where to start? What are the baby steps?
No, great question. First, I want to give credit to Maria Montessori, because Maria Montessori created her system 100 years ago. And I would say the reason it's not much more widely adopted is the dominance of government schooling systems. There's been a tiny bit of Montessori within government systems, but for the most part, the two are inconsistent. So without getting into the details of the Montessori, the way I think about it is kids do need to learn reading, writing, and arithmetic. You know, there's the whole, you know, there are basic academic skills that at a, you know, some level are useful. And so we do need something like schools to develop kids' ability to read. Although after they learn the basics of reading, it really is read lots and read difficult and varied materials. And then write, I actually find that most students who become voracious readers, I am concerned about the lack of reading. I think reading and writing are becoming, you know, replaced by video for a lot of young people. And so I think if we can get more young people reading and writing a lot, that's good. And even if they use, say, GPT to supplement their writing, they still need to be the kind of thinker who can structure their own ideas, organize their own ideas, develop their own opinions in order to become a capable adult. Quick side note on that point. My son works on Amazon as a senior data scientist, and he's as mathy as you can be. But Amazon has a culture where every meeting, everybody reads a memo, you know, written by one of the staff. And so as a data scientist, one of my son's most important roles, and what he spends most of his time doing, is writing. And obviously, he cannot use GPT to do his writing for him. When Amazon executives are making big decisions about, you know, global servers, he needs to organize his understanding of the system into well-thought-out bullet points, basically, in his memos. So I think reading and writing by human beings is going to be here for a long time. Students do need to develop high-level reading and writing skills. And then shifting to math, No, one of my friends is John Mackey, the founder and CEO of Whole Foods Market, a Fortune 500 corporation. John hated school. He said he only went to high school for girls and sports, and thought the classes were a total waste of time. And he says all the math he needed to run Whole Foods he learned in middle school. So you do need to know fractions and decimals and percentages and, you know, financial math, accounting math. But you don't need calculus, for instance. You know, certainly engineers do. So again, if you're going to go into physics or engineering, absolutely, the more math, the better. But for maybe 2/3 of our students, what they really need are basics of financial math. And so going back to concretely what we do is we teach both personal finance and business finance for our entrepreneurial and creative students. So to kind of think at a high level, as much reading and writing as possible, you can never become too good at those skills. Also thinking and speaking, that's where the Socratic dialogue comes in. Then certainly math up to basic financial math. And then I think you go into either a lot more if you're going to be a scientist or engineer. Again, no such thing as too much math for those careers. But for our entrepreneurial and creative students, let's just nail the financial math. Then beyond those core reading, writing, math experiences, exploration, expose them to lots of ideas, lots of skills, lots of adult professionals. Students, young people do need to find their way, and they don't know a lot about the world. Most of them, are in their, whatever they know from their family and their friends are all they know. So we feel an obligation to expose them to a lot of interesting things in history and interesting things in science, interesting things in digital skills. But there, it's not so much about didactic teaching where we give them tests and grades and so forth. It's we want them to be excited about the endless possibilities in the world. I'm very excited about progress studies, the whole developing field of how did humanity get to where it is and how can we keep moving forward with progress. And I find that young people are excited about these things. So if one is focusing on beyond the reading, writing, math into exposing them to all sorts of fascinating things about the world they didn't know without the pressure to cover traditional curriculum, they become engaged, excited learners, and gradually they discover what they might want to do with their life. And then we shift into the role of coaches and mentors. How do we help them achieve the goals that they want? Then you're no longer, basically enforcing a prison system. I regard standard schooling as a quasi-prison system because most of the students don't want to be there. A lot of behavioral problems are because you're forcing kids who don't want to be there to do things they don't like. And as a consequence, if we liberate the prisoners and support them in achieving goals they care about, which are often making money when they're young, then they're such a pleasure to work with. We're all aligned in terms of let's help you have a fabulous life. Now, to give you some examples, I have a couple of teenage girls who want to become digital nomads and travel around the world. And if I support them in learning skills so they can make money and travel, they are so into it, which makes sense. One more data point, then I'll pause again. 75% of high school students in the United States are unhappy at school. 2/3 are not engaged in learning. Well, finally, 30% increase in teen suicides during the school year, with some Mondays almost double the suicide rate compared to July. So I see adolescence in the United States as a catastrophe. I think we're the leading edge of a catastrophe globally. There's a lot of attention on the role of social media in causing the adolescent mental health crisis. I think schooling, government-enforced, top-down, one-size-fits-all schooling is a leading cause of adolescent mental health issues and adolescent dysfunction. Now, there's a famous experiment called Rat Park, where they got rats addicted to cocaine, and then as soon as they let the rats free to run around in a park, the rats didn't care about the cocaine anymore. They'd rather be out there doing things. And so I think all of the problems we see with young people, maybe not all, but a significant amount, are we are caging these energetic, vibrant people who should be out there creating businesses and taking initiative and adventuring. And as a consequence, we've got a growing catastrophe around the world. I'll pause my rant. But,
no, thank you, Michael. Very, very interesting points you've made so far. And let me just jump on to a principle that is close to liberals in general. And if you're talking about the liberal foundation of education, it is about equal access, providing equal access to education, but it's also about merit-based progression. So these two principles, one on what you described, sounds incredibly resource intensive. It sounds much more a mentor-based model where the mentor is, you know, really vested in this one child's development through a period of time. And that requires incredible amount of resources, or does it? Is that, that's, you know, one of super, the questions.
Super great question. And I'll acknowledge a tension there. But the way I think about the tension, I'm going to go way back. In 1800, there was a 18-year-old kid, Lancaster, I think his first name was John Lancaster, and he created a system at the time. He himself was working class. He created a system called the Lancaster system, where it was students teaching students teaching students, you know, with an adult at the very top. But through this system, he managed to get teacher-student ratios of 1 to 100, 1 to 500, 1 to 1,000. And so the obviously way to reduce cost is, instead of relying on expensive credentialed adults, which is what all government systems rely on, there's the belief that that's what you need. You have tiers of young people, in effect, mentoring younger people. And that actually works better. Again, I find that a 13-year-old looks up to a 16-year-old, whereas they don't care about a 14-year-old, they want the respect of the 16-year-old. And of course, the 16-year-old wants the respect of the 18-year-old. And so we human beings are built to care about what those just a little bit older than us think about. And as a consequence, you know, one of the most potent ways I've found to get kids motivated is to bring young people who exemplify the traits that they want. So I'll give you one example. I've got somebody teaching coding and video production at my school, who himself hated school, dropped out at 12, was homeschooled and taught himself video production and coding. And he has no high school diploma, no college degree. He's just a 20-year-old kid who all the other kids really love and really look up to. And he self-taught himself these skills. So of course, he's the ideal teacher of younger people with these skills. So I'm pretty radical in terms of, and this is tricky because many countries and even some states in the U.S. Won't allow somebody without a credential to teach. But this is why to address the issue you bring up, to create a low-cost version of this, we need to get the expensive adults out of the way, many of whom are perceived as socially irrelevant by the kids, and create these systems of young people teaching young people. And that's the way to get cost way down. And I would say actually to improve quality in the long run.
So one of the other things about equal access is also catering to children with different abilities. And the model that you now propose, say, for example, if we have mentors that are much low cost, perhaps that's a better way to go about it. But what about, merit-based progression? Because do we need standardization then at some point to say, oh, this is the test you need to pass in order to qualify yourself for this, you know, certain set of skill set and so on and so forth? Or standardization at every point of time kills the creativity that you're talking about that is perhaps unique to individuals? And a follow-up to that also, I wanted to bring across the point is, when you talk about all these examples, it's almost like your school's filled with very, very special individuals with unique skill set. Is that true? Can an average kid also perform similarly if given the right amount of mentoring and resources that you've so far, or the methods that you've talked about? Is it, you know, applicable in a larger context, especially when we're talking about mass-produced education, because the pressure of like incoming batches is always there for, especially if you want to provide education for all?
Great question. I'll start with the latter and then go to the former. So can everybody do this? In all traditional cultures, at the age of around 12, you took on adult responsibilities. This used to be normal. I see government schooling as the biggest campaign to infantilize children in human history. just 150 years ago, it was basically normal for young people to do this. There's a famous book by a psychologist who was the head of psychology today called The Case Against Adolescence. Adolescence is a term that was invented in the early 1900s. Teenager was a term that was invented in the early 1900s. Prior to that, you went out and got a job. Oh, and so it just used to be so normal. And so I think people, we've been trained to assume that kids are incapable because we've created a system that makes them incapable. John Taylor Gatto's book, the title of it is Dumbing Us Down. And in this sense, he believes schools have made us stupider. And not necessarily strictly from, say, a math knowledge basis, but in terms of, I would say, being intellectually and emotionally dependent. School makes us, on average, stupider. Going to your former point about merit, I'm all about merit, but of course, there are lots of different kinds of merit. If you want to get into a science or engineering school, of course, you should be expected to pass a test on mathematics. You know, there's a role for tests in mathematics. But if you wanted to get into a world-class choir, you should have an audition where you demonstrate your singing ability and not take a math test. You know, it would be absurd to have a singing audition for an engineering school and absurd to have a math test for a choir, world-class choir. And so the way I see it, in a natural market, we would, of course, be extremely meritocratic, but each domain would be based on what counts as merit within that domain. And in fact, we would see new types of ability come to matter. Give you a case. I'm very interested in innovations and careers. So I once met a woman who was one of the lead UX designers for Facebook. She probably made $1 million more a year. And her story was, in the 1990s, most websites were made by men, and they were incredibly ugly. Now, if you ever go back and look at a 1990s website, they're hideous. And so she started just making their websites look nicer. And basically, she bootstrapped herself into a new career that did not exist at that point, and now is incredibly successful by it. So, you know, going back to your merit thing, what counts as merit? You know, with AI, AI is changing the world. What will count as merit 10 years from now? We have no idea. And again, AI makes me even more radical about the schooling system being obsolete. We're having kids take high school chemistry in a world where AI is changing things at the most rapid pace in human history. And they should be figuring out how do they leverage their human abilities vis-a-vis various sorts of generative AI. And I would postulate that given the right mentors and exposure to the right, cutting-edge frameworks, they will do a better job at making themselves valuable 10 years from now than simply studying for tests will.
Thank you, Michael. Now, this takes us right to the question, what the private sector can do in the education system. Obviously, it is a liberal principle that you want the private sector to take a significant role in public affairs. And so still we are struggling with this debate that would be a contentious one, whether there should be private schools, whether education should be in private hands. People would fear that the elite monopolizes the quality education. They would be worried that ordinary people would still have access to the education that they need. Now, obviously, the situation isn't as black and white as this. We have public schools, for example, in the country of Estonia, that are very much run by the community. And at the same time, we have in the US the so-called charter schools, which are basically private schools, but government funded and also follow government curricula. So it is complex, and one wonders, does ownership really matter?
Ownership matters tremendously. Again, I think all innovation comes from the margins. In every case, Clayton Christensen famously wrote his book, Disruptive Innovation. And he pointed out that even in the private sector, large corporations gradually tend to become less innovative over time because the incentive structure of everybody in the organization is to do a better job of what they've already been doing. But if one wants to create schools that are as radically different as I envision, you know, just imagine a school designed to create careers that don't yet exist. You cannot have a system of people who are trying to do a better job of what has already been. Going to charter schools, at one point I created a charter school in the US, and again, it did very well. But I would never do so again because there were too many limitations on innovation. We still had to cover standard curricula. I still had to hire certified teachers. I still had to use the state accountability tests. Again, I'm not against tests, but I want the freedom to, for kids whose life is going to be optimized by something other than the test, not to be measured by that test. And so the danger of government funding is that there will be strings attached, and the strings attached will typically make it more like the regular schools. There's a debate about this in the US right now. Whereas, you know, if you think about 1,000-to-1 systems of one teacher and 1,000 students with tiers of different students teaching different students, teaching them entirely new things in generative AI that we don't even know about, that is so, and becoming entrepreneurs earning money in their teens, that is so different from the system we have. There's no way that a government system is going to allow that in the foreseeable future. I know people that are trying to change government systems, and they can sometimes make a little bit of progress. They're heroes, good for them. But I think the pace of change is so urgently needed that we need to empower the private sector as much as possible, as quickly as possible. One more footnote on that. My wife is from Africa. And there we see people getting bachelor's and master's degrees and being unemployed. They drive taxis around. You know, there's this belief in traditional education and all they can do is be a taxi driver. Meanwhile, I've got these teenagers making lots of money online. And, you know, she and other Africans who think this way are, we need to get our teenagers making money online and not get a PhD and drive a cab.
Many of my colleagues who study with me in Berlin are also taxi drivers. So I can relate to that. But what about content coming from private sources? I mean, we do have ed tech providers. We have so much now on the market already. Is this the model? I know there is a problem with the sustainable supply of these services when the private sector might exit the market, and schools are probably in trouble maintaining their education system in the school. But what do you think about private suppliers of education?
I'm very big on private suppliers, and more broadly, especially into tech. I think that as education goes forward, tech should do what tech does best and humans should do what humans do best. And so we use adaptive math software in our schools. And going to your thing of exiting the market, just an adaptive math. So adaptive math allows students to go at their own rate. It provides students with a math problems that's not too hard, not too easy, just right for them. And there are dozens, probably hundreds of different suppliers. And we actually allow our students a choice of which adaptive math program they use. They can use Khan Academy, which is free, or we've got something else called MathSpace. And we've also occasionally had students who want to use a different one. And so again, rather than thinking this is the one solution, even with privately supplied math apps, we let students figure out what works best for them. As long as they're learning the math, why should we care? And, you know, in the private sector, you know, you go to a restaurant you love and it goes out of business, you go to a different restaurant. Just not a big deal. With radical pluralism, that's what competition does. It creates more options that are each more lower cost, higher quality, more suited to your needs. And then again, with EdTech, generative AI is changing things with astonishing rapidity. And so what even counts as ed tech a year from now is going to look so much different from what it looks like right now that, and government's not even remotely playing a role in this. And so I see students figuring out what they need with the help of mentors. Going back to your point, Arpita, I think what humans do best are things like Socratic dialogue, mentoring, you know, coaching, these sorts of things. And increasingly, a lot of the content transmission will be done by tech because tech is so personalized. There's a big issue in the literature on how personalized tutoring helps people learn much faster. And tech is getting to that point where it's beginning to fulfill that promise. But I think with a human being as mentor, coach, we have mentors who help students figure out their direction. Because it is, once you have all this choice, even at the student level, it's hard to figure out direction. And human beings are often better at that. And above all, I think young human beings do want attention and respect from somewhat older human beings. And so I see a system evolving with, you know, countless private suppliers providing a range of educational options we literally cannot imagine right now, with human beings helping younger people figure out how to optimize their experience within the tech.
Well, Michael, it's almost like a great conversation in general, because I feel like recently I've read Jonathan Haidt's book on the anxious generation, and before that, The Coddling of the American Mind. And you've almost solved all the problems regarding the behavioral issues if we just keep our focus on how we can get education to do better. I just want to bring you back to, can we then, in a liberal education framework, at least as a classical liberal who believes in an education framework that puts individual at the center, what would be like the practical steps in terms of education policy? What are the key takeaways, you know, we can overall frame so that we can actually actualize some of these education policies? Do you have some key takeaways for us?
Well, thank you. Great question. So in the US, I'm a big fan of educational scholarship accounts, ESAs. They are the least regulated form of school choice, where parents can take, Arizona pioneered this. In Arizona, every family can use $7,500 from the state to do almost anything they want with respect to their child's education. So they can homeschool, unschool, microschool, learning pods. They can join my program, the Socratic Experience. And as a consequence, that allows for innovation. The reason it's really important that they're unregulated is that students can therefore do very non-traditional approaches like what I'm describing. Milton Friedman originally proposed vouchers, and I, in one sense, like the idea, but the danger of a voucher is that the state would say, this voucher can only go to a school that is accredited with certified teachers. Then we're all back to the strings attached. We're all back to the traditional model. There is a danger that ESAs will become more regulated. And I'm very acutely attuned to that and interested in the battle to keep them unregulated. Because just in Arizona, for instance, there have been complaints that parents would use these ESAs to buy Legos or flat screen TVs or horse riding lessons. And my reaction is, those are legitimate. and especially, you know, I'm totally with you, Arpita. I see the school system as so damaging that simply in terms of well-being, I mean, suicide, my goodness, if your child is at risk of suicide, take them out, use the $7,500, and alive is better than dead. It's that, to be blunt. And so I think we need to really change the mental model that people have around how different education can or should be. And then that should lead to educational policies where, if school government funding is used, there are as few strings attached as possible. And then ultimately, I see this as sort of a crack in the dike sort of situation, where as more people realize that the old education system is simply obsolete and not serving our children, most children anyway, there might be some children, maybe as many as 20 or 30% who do fine in that, they can stay in that system, but it's not serving most children optimally. And as more parents realize that, I think the floodgates will open and we'll see a lot of children leaving the system. Just, I live in Austin, which is arguably at the cutting edge of educational innovation. And there are so many billionaires and centimillionaires who are creating their own little private alternative schools because they realize the old system is obsolete. They can afford to do whatever they want. So they create a little micro school often in their homes with the kinds of things that they want for their children, which broadly are somewhat similar to the kinds of things I've been talking about. High-level skills, reading, writing, math, and then a lot of freedom to explore, and then support them in doing amazing things as young as possible.
Wouldn't just one pushback on the key takeaway, especially with ESAs like the ones in Arizona, wouldn't it be a challenge for say, for example, homeschool children to get sucked into cult ideologies or extreme form of ideologies? How would a liberal education system counter something like that?
That's a great question. And the first answer is, yes, that will happen sometimes. That will happen. On the other hand, I would say, I think one of the things that will drive or limit that is every parent wants their child to have a successful career. And if you get too far out there in weirdness, you're not employable. No, and so the basic drive to be a successful adult naturally limits that. And of course, part of it depends on what you count as weird cult, but there are people who think some aspects of the public education system amount to a weird cult as well. And so I see it as more aligned with, to be a happy, successful adult, there are certain characteristics you need. And parents want their children, all parents want their children to be happy and well as an adult. And so that will kind of drive a certain kind of sensibility for the most part. Again, some weirdos out there always have been, always will be. But commercial society itself drives a certain kind of, let's just do what's best for our kids.
Great. I think we are more or less done with our questions. Thank you so much for your time, Michael. It's been an absolute pleasure to catch up with you and explore your brilliant mind in terms of new forms of education that we should be exploring and a new way of looking at education overall.
Thank you. It's been a delight to be here. Good to see you again, Rainer. And good to see you. Good to meet you, Arpita.
Let me now turn to Path. Path, I have introduced you earlier, and let me say how glad we are that you are here today with us in this podcast episode on the constituting principles of a liberal education system.
Now, I'm glad that you invited me to join you.
Thank you, Path. We were just talking to Michael about the role of the private sector, and he's told us very clearly ownership matters a lot. But it still obviously is a contentious matter for a lot of people. I'm not so sure whether it's actually more of a contentious matter or issue in more affluent societies, or is it really such an issue everywhere in the world? And I'm going in the direction, of course, of your experience. A path, you have worked for many years with so-called low-cost private schools or budget private schools in India. You even have helped to set up this association that now has, I read, 80,000 of these schools, and I know that there are roughly 300,000 of those schools in India. So, I mean, obviously, there's a huge amount of these so-called low-cost private schools. And even your neighboring country, Pakistan, is famous for having a lot of these schools. About 40% of all school-going children in Pakistan are actually attending private schools, which is quite an amazing number for many people in other countries. Now, Path, I wanted to ask you, can you share a little bit more, like, what are these budget private schools? It would help us to understand a little bit more about this. And does that mean that the discussion about school ownership in India is a little less about the elite monopolizing school access and more about universal access to education, like in rural areas? Can you shed a bit of light for us on this topic?
I think that's really a very insightful question in terms of ownership and performance. We have a debate in India, not just in terms of in the education system, but also across the economic system, because India has had a large number of sectors which have been nationalized historically. And therefore, we have seen the performance of government ownership in, of course, education as well as in other industries. And given the debate in India, broader debate in India, my sense is the ownership does matter. For one reason, particularly, is that the ownership decides the command that you get in terms of how to run your organization. So the government owns schools, the government owns a banking system or a particular industry, then obviously the whole industry has to function by certain common standards. And that commonality actually destroys diversity, destroys innovation, destroys sort of ways of serving the customer in better ways. Then they become sort of ossified in the way they have been doing their business when they came to that ownership structure, right? So my sense is that the ownership matters a lot. And therefore, I see in India, for example, the budget private schools are performing better because they're owned. by private individuals and societies and groups, and not by government, right? Just to give your listener a background, you said Pakistan has about 40% students who go to private schools. India actually does even better. We have half of the students, more than half of the students who go to private schools. And that's really astonishing number for a country like India at the development and income level that we are, where some of the poorest people send the children to private schools. And that is not because there are no government schools. By now, government schools are almost every neighborhood, right? And they are free. In many cases, they are not just free in terms of tuition fee, but also government gives you free textbooks, free uniform, and in most cases, also free midday meal. So you get all of those sort of things for free if you go to a government school. Even then, poor parents choose to go to private school where they actually pay the fee, they pay for the uniform, they pay for the textbooks, or obviously they pay for the meals, right? So you have to ask yourself how bad your product or service has to be that you cannot even give away for free.
And is it really a question of quality? Is that really, the determining factor here? Private schools are better?
And I think quality often gets defined in different ways. I know you can talk about that a little bit if you think that's worthwhile. But I think it's very important to understand how parents see quality of education, right? Particularly the poor parents, and how we educationists, researchers, you can say the system, right, sees quality in education. And I think that is huge, unfortunately, differencing how parents and the system see quality. So we did a school voucher pilot program in New Delhi, which is the capital city of India, very urban area, right? And through 3 years of the pilot program that we ran, I got to meet with parents and, of course, same group of parents over a three-year period. So I could establish some kind of rapport with them, gain some confidence from them, so they are free to share what they actually think as opposed to what they think I want to hear, right? So I think given that, I got a good sort of understanding of how parents see choice of private school that they are making at a huge sacrifice to their livelihood, because they spend almost one third in some cases on education of their meager income in private school, even when government schools are available for free right next door, right? And what you understand from those conversations is that parents see things that usually, frankly, middle-class people laugh at, that this is what schools do. For example, the schools, most of the low-fee private schools, budget private schools particularly, will check the uniform of the student every morning. So when you have morning assembly, along with what you do there, the teacher will go around checking your uniform, whether it's clean or not, whether it's somewhat pressed, right? And your shoes are clean, properly tied, the socks are at the right length that they are supposed to be, right? So all of those things are checked. And of course, we laugh at that. No, why anybody should worry about those things? They also check your nails. So they would ask the students to sort of, extend their hands, and they will check nails whether they are clean, they are cut or not. All of those things happens every morning in the school assembly, right? And parents actually value that so much. And I had never realized how much they value it. Because in their own life, where the slums in which they live, there is never any cleanliness, right? And it's very difficult to maintain a white uniform, let alone keep it ironed, right? And they see this is a sort of different world they are creating for their kids, right? Which is not available to them back home and will never be available to them back home, right? Given the situation they are in. And so for them, that itself is such a huge value that my kid goes to a school where someone in the school checks their uniform, checks their nail. So that brings cleanliness, right? That brings attention to hygiene, right? Their hair is properly combed or not, particularly for girls. That is also being checked in the school, right? So those are the things actually parents value so much. For example, most of these schools will close their gate anyways after the starting time of the school, right? You think parents would be opposed to that because they sometimes, of course, miss the timeline and kid has to go back home. But they actually like it because they think that brings punctuality. that puts some discipline in the sort of heart and mind of the child, that I should show up on time, right? Again, that is not something that happens in their life otherwise. There's nothing, frankly, in their life other than going to an employer, right, for the parents, that requires punctuality, right? And so that value for,
Yeah, I just wanted to ascertain and make sure we all understand this correctly, because you said the word slums. I just want to make sure. So we're really talking about the poorest here. So we're not talking about a slightly higher income strata that can actually afford those private schools. We're really talking about the poorest that are sending their children to private schools, even though they would have to pay a tuition fee.
Yes, yes. I think it's a good point that you raise. I sort of explained the fact that India, even though 50% of the children go to private schools, there are two types of private schools. One, which is for upper middle class and the richer sort of part of society. And those schools are obviously very similar to what you would see in the Western country, right? They're very well furnished, very nice buildings, very well-trained teachers, right? They have swimming pools, and many places also have a horse riding stables, right? So those are the kind of schools where, you know, many of the children go to, right? And they're obviously recognized schools. They're affiliated to international boards, or there's a different level of sort of schooling that happens in those schools. But those are about 10% of the schools. 90% of the schools in India, which are private, are for the poor, lower middle class and the poor, right? And those schools usually don't really have a proper buildings. They're running a sort of one floor of a sort of society or a private building, residential building, right? Many of them don't meet any infrastructure norms in terms of the classroom size. So India has a Right to Education Act, and the act defines exactly what should be the classroom size. It says minimum classroom should be 300 square feet, right? Hardly any house in the whole slum is 300 square feet, let alone a school classroom, right? Because the number of children are far smaller in those schools, and therefore they can do much smaller classrooms. It's a requirement of having particular number of books in the library, right? So there are lots of infrastructure requirements put under the by the law. Most of these schools don't meet those requirements, right? So they are actually, in some sense, exist at the boundary of legality, right? Often they are threatened for closure. You will read in the newspaper almost every other week that some group of schools in some state or a place are being threatened for closure, right? It's a very common feature. And so those are the kind of schools we are talking about. And these are the schools the parents are choosing to pay for when they have a next door, completely free government school, which offers free textbooks, free uniforms, free meals.
True. That's very fascinating, Parth, because I think what you are talking about segues into one of the other principles in terms of a liberal model for education that we want to think about or talk about. And what's very important for us is school autonomy, right? So to a certain extent, these private schools are offering these choices in terms of what I care about in terms of my kids' education. And these schools are sort of, you know, catering to that audience to a large extent. I was wondering just in terms of management, these especially low-cost budget private schools that we're talking about that have proliferated in India, what does that management structure look like? How do they retain their autonomy? Is there a curriculum that they need to follow? You know, like you said, like the right to education, you know, specifies certain standards you have to meet. So how are they maintaining? What is their operation style like? That would be a very fascinating thing for our audience.
As I said, they're at the margin of legality, right? So most of them do not meet all the requirements under the law. And therefore, they are not officially recognized by the government. So there are some cases, the local government, city governments do recognize them because they know they're a very important part of the system. Without them, it will be very difficult for government to manage education of all the poor kids in the city, right? Half of those kids are going to the private schools. And so they recognize the importance of them, even though, of course, they don't really treat them well. There's always this sort of disdain towards private schools being seen as sort of people who are making money on the back of the poor. They don't realize that these schools are actually like community schools. So person who starts a school of this kind is not someone, a business person coming from outside who wants to start a business in the slum, right? Usually a slum dweller, one of the persons living there who sees this huge gap between what parents want, right? And what the kids are getting and feels that maybe they can do something about it, right? And that's how many of these schools get started. And therefore, usually there's a huge commitment from the community itself, right? Is that there are community schools, people have good accountability in that sense, right? And so I think autonomy-wise, they are quite autonomous because they are at the boundary of the legality. So no law applies to them as much. But there's a huge pressure of the board exam. So as it is common in many parts of the world, there is a sort of board exam that you take at the end of the 12th year when you from the high school. And every school, obviously, student has to appear for the board exam because that is what decides your entry into the college, right? And given the fact that we have shortage of good colleges, the board exams have become very high-pressured, high sort of valued exams, right? And therefore, there's a pressure from top down on the schools to meet certain standards, to follow certain curriculum, right? Even though they may be free to do other things, right? So it's quite perverse in some sense. That is not the government in this case is putting so much control over the private schools. It's actually the board that they're affiliated to, and they have to be affiliated to the boards, right? Which are the ones who are putting the pressure on them to become more standardized and more uniform in what they deliver to the kids, right? So which is interesting sort of paradox in some sense. The government has given you a lot more freedom in a way, but the system, the board exams are putting pressure on you to be more conformist.
But so say, for example, let's stick to the principle of saying schools should be autonomous, or like we say, is it really autonomy just for the school to decide in terms of curriculum, the pedagogical method that you use, or the teaching materials that you use, so on and so forth. And you're saying there's a market pressure now coming from the college level that is sort of, you know, driving this standardization process. But one of the logics that most like governments, when they want to control the curriculum or education or control school autonomy, one of the logic that's often used is, oh, but we, you know, we can't give school autonomy because it might lead down to rabbit holes of these extreme ideologies of like people just learning, you know, nothing of relevance that the government feels is relevant in terms of education. So how do you see this duality working in India? Is there a concern from either the central level, the federal level or the state level, specifically in terms of languages? Because in India, you have such a diversity of languages, right? And so what if I only learn, say, for example, in the South, only in Tamil language? And am I really accessing the education that is probably widely spread and available in English? So, you know, is there a reason for this standardization? Do you see a logic behind this standardization? Or should schools really be left at that autonomous level to decide and, you know, more respond to market forces rather than, you know, government deciding the curriculum?
I think the point about language Italy is very important. As you pointed out, that India has about 26 sort of large languages that few million people speak. And government has tried to control what language of instruction is used in schools, right? So that is, and almost every central government has tried to sort of impose their own view of what is a national language for India. But by default, English has become a sort of national language, right? And one of the attractions for private schools, for even poor parents, is that much of the, at least the written work which is done for exams and the textbooks which are used are in English language. So even though teaching may not be fully in English language because the teacher themselves probably don't speak as much English or as fluently the language, right? So that could be in local mix, local language plus English. But the attraction for English is very high. So that is really a default national language, right? So finally, governments have come to realize that. So in the last sort of 5-7 years or so, many state governments have allowed even government schools to offer English medium education, right? And go beyond the state language, state official language in which the instruction was given in all government schools earlier, right? So I think there is an understanding that English is going to be by default a national language of India. And we know from research that there's a huge premium for English language, right? Even if you can barely speak English That is, you understand even few words and few sentences. You're working as a driver, for example. The huge difference in how much you would earn if you work for a local family versus if you're able to work for an expat family, right? Or for an embassy or an international multilateral body, right? So even though you're doing the same function of being a driver, there's a huge difference in terms of how you are treated, right? And what you make as a driver, if you're able to speak English, even somewhat decently, right? So there's a huge premium for that, right? So I think autonomy is really not as big a concern that I see, at least not in private schools. There's, of course, concern in government schools. And that has been part of our campaign, one of the campaign that we ran in India in terms of school choice campaign. One reform idea was to give more autonomy to government schools. So we argued that government schools should have at least as much autonomy as private schools enjoy, if you want government schools to compete with private schools, right? So you cannot expect them to compete with private schools, and they are unable to compete, unfortunately, right? Because their hands are tied in many ways, right? Almost every decision of the school is taken by the department, not by the principal or the teachers in the school, right? So I think that would be certainly one huge reform to give autonomy to government schools and thereby at least help them improve quality, because we need both kinds of school, frankly, right? So no system is going to be great by having just one kind of school. So given the diversity of India, the levels of income diversity and all of that, you need government schools, you also need private schools, right? And you need to sort of provide them autonomy so both can do well as much as possible for their children and students.
I'm just wondering, as a quick follow-up, what role do you see teachers' union play in that? Like, I'm surprised that there hasn't been a backlash from government schools' teachers' union on shutting down private schools because their salary is dependent on, like, I don't know how many schools they, how the schools operate or how many students. And if there are too few students, government schools tend to shut down. So what has been the backlash, or have you gotten them on board in your overall campaign of saying we should provide educational choices to parents?
I think we tried in the early years to work with the teacher unions because at some level we had the same common interest, is the welfare of the students who are coming to our schools, right? We found that, you know, there's a huge sort of discrepancy between private school teachers and the government school teachers in terms of the pay. So government school teachers in India, given the per capita income that India has, are one of the highest paid in the world. This is a UN research that shows that Indian teachers are the top three in the world, right? In terms of per capita income that we have in India. And given that discrepancy, they are, of course, in a sense, very elite group of teachers within the system. And they are not threatened by private schools because they know that their jobs are secured. Yes. Not many jobs are opening up because obviously government schools are not really demanded as much. So that is a constraint in terms of how many new people can join the system. But those who are part of the system really have nothing to fear. Right? And therefore, first, they did not really work with us. They, of course, opposed. When we used to do our school choice conference, you would see outside some of the teacher union guys protesting against the idea of choice. The idea that poor parents can make a choice of any kind, that will be wise for them, right? The effort has not been very successful in working with them.
This is so interesting because it also takes us back to what we had heard from Michael earlier when he compared some schools to prisons where children have to be forced to follow a certain set of rules, learn things that might not be correspond with their talents and their interests. And obviously, some schools that break out of this have much more potential to really work according to what the children have in terms of their abilities and also what they would like to do in terms of their preferences. This is an issue we could discuss at length and much longer, because it also leads us to the question whether it's just school autonomy or whether it should be teacher autonomy. But, we have so far covered so many interesting aspects. We want to cover basically the pillars of a liberal education system. We've spoken about the promotion of individual freedom and the autonomy of the individual. We've also covered the question of equal access to education and a merit-based progression system. We had this discussion about the private sector, or rather private ownership of schools, and to what extent it matters. And now we just spoke about school autonomy. There's one area left that we really want to address, and that's something we want to take to path. And that is the question of parental rights and responsibilities that must be at the core of a liberal education system. Quickly, parental rights would include, for example, that they have the freedom to select the school that they want for their child, a certain amount of educational customization so that, you know, their children learn what their parents also believe is something they should be learning. School funding, obviously, through student enrollment. We have discussed that earlier, the slogan that the money should go to the kids and not to the schools. Homeschooling sometimes is an important matter for parents to choose on. And of course, cultural and value-based education. So there are certain rights parents should have. At the same time, parents also would have to have some responsibilities, which means they need to prepare them for the education process. Make them interested in learning in the first place before they come to school, for example. Give them a certain amount of willpower that they can overcome potential challenges. So children sometimes have never learned that in their early years, and then they struggle to deal with this when they go to school. And once they are in school, we want the parents to stay involved. We want them to, you know, give feedback to the teachers, to the schools, how is this working for them, and so on. So there's a lot of responsibilities and many rights that we want parents to have. Coming back to the parents that you just spoke about, Path, living in the slums, they would be working from the very early hours in the morning. They're sweeping the streets, they're collecting the garbage, they are street vendors. They work so hard all day long. They can hardly take a break. How can they still exercise these responsibilities? Do they have that in your experience? And what about their rights? Do they have the educational background? Are they, I would say many experts would argue that it's better for the teachers to decide how their kids should, how the kids should progress in school, and maybe not the teachers, because they just don't have the professional knowledge for that. What's your experience, especially now with these many low-cost private schools in India?
That's an important question. I think you also raised, good reminder early on in your comment that a parent cannot have a choice unless teachers and principals and schools have a choice of what they want to offer, right? So unless you have a system in which the schools can decide whether I want to follow this pedagogy or that pedagogy or this curriculum or that curriculum, right? Teachers have a freedom to decide how they want to conduct their classes. So unless you offer the freedom to those individuals and entities, you cannot really have a parental choice, which is in any way meaningful, right? I think important to understand that for parents to have a choice, the choice would exist for all people within the system, right? Including teachers, schools and principals, and obviously the education boards of various kinds that we have. So those choices are very important to create a kind of environment of choice within the school system. Now, I think the question, and as always has been a big debate in our sort of work in India, that can these parents who themselves are illiterate, right? And there are many parents who have not gone to school even today in India, or have gone to school but not really learned much, and they are illiterate in any functional sense, right? Would they be able to make a decision about what's a good school for the kids, right? And that's an, I think, important question. So I don't want to minimize that. At the same time, I think one can look at the experience and see what is required to choose a school, right? So often I think we sometimes overplay this requirement of what is expected of parents to be able to make good choices, right? And so I made a distinction earlier between what parents are looking at in terms of quality and what the educationists see as a quality. So most of the research which compares government schools and private schools is based on assessing learning outcomes. And those are usually the 3 R's broadly defined, which is what you can test people on in a short period of time when the researcher goes into a school, right? What parents actually value are punctuality, hygiene, cleanliness, the fact that teacher is present every day and making an effort, however poor that may be, at least she is trying her best. The homework is given, the homework is checked, is a report card that says something about the child, even though they may not understand much of that, right? So all of those are good signals to them, right? When we're doing this work in Educate School Choice campaign, I was traveling around the country at the time. And in one of the southern states, we asked a group of parents, how do you know which school is a good school? Right. And an answer we got is that the school is good school in which there are teachers from the state of Kerala. So for them, the teachers coming from that one particular state, which is, of course, a highly educated state, the most educated state in the country. So if you have a teacher coming from that state, that has to be a good school, because the teacher will not go to a bad school, because that teacher has a good choices. He is offering a very high level service in a way, being a good teacher herself, right? So if the school is able to hire that teacher, that means the school, of course, willing to invest money in hiring a good teacher. They are paying much higher salary than they would have to pay to a local teacher for that matter, right? And therefore, the school is focused on learning. Now, no research would ever catch that the schools, whichever teacher, at least one teacher from Kerala, is going to be a good school, right? But those are the markers, right? And that, when you begin to think about it, that really makes sense, right? Even though the parent, of course, was not able to articulate when we ask, why do you think Kerala teachers would be good teachers? So why do you think that school would be a good school? They couldn't say much, right? You begin to reflect on it and you see that that's really is a very wise choice as a marker for a good school, right? So even though I can't assess curriculum, even though I can't assess what the teacher is doing in the school, I can't even read my daughter's homework. I'm illiterate, right? I have no way to judge whether that's right or wrong, right? But I have this kind of markers. And I think often the education is downplay this wisdom, right? That the parents have, even when they are uneducated, right? I think I make a distinction between being educated and being wise in making choices. And those two are not the same thing, right? Those are not the same thing. If you have time, I can give you one more example of actually solid research being done. This was done in Pakistan, the country that you mentioned earlier. So the researchers gave a sort of piece of paper to every parent and said, rank the school in your town. There are about 8 or 9 schools in the town, very small town. Ask them, even though you may not know the schools, please rank them according to which one you think are the best schools in the town. And they collected ranking from the parents of these 8 or 9 schools in the town. And then they send the education experts and say, now you go there and assess this school by the parameters that you think are the best parameters to judge a good school, given the, of course, context in which these schools worked and existed in that Pakistani town, right? And they give their own ranking, right? So you got a ranking from the parents and you now got a ranking from the experts. And the question they ask is, what is the coefficient of correlation between the two rankings, right? And that tells you how similar those rankings are or how dissimilar they are. And turns out, I don't want to take a guess, but turns out that, you know, it's pretty high correlation, almost 0.8, right? So one would mean exactly same ranking, zero would mean exactly opposite ranking, right? 0.8 is very similar. So here you have a illiterate, uneducated, you can say ill-informed parents who are ranking the schools, some of which they don't even know, possibly they never went to those schools, right? And you have experts ranking those schools and you get very similar ranking. Now, the difference, I think, which is important for us to understand for the discussion, is that if you ask the parent, any of those parents, why did you rank this school number 4 and that school number 6? And they would just fumble. They would have no way to articulate their reasoning, right? So why did I rank this number 4 and that number 6? If you ask the expert, they can give you 1,000 reasons why this school is number 4 and that school is number 6, right? So I think difference that we are putting emphasis on is the capacity to articulate your reasoning or your rationale for a choice, not so much about the wisdom of choice itself.
Still makes you question the value of a college education of all these experts. This is a very interesting point. To conclude that point, I was wondering, Parth, from your experience, if you were to give policymakers like one
advice, key advice, what would you suggest to them in this area? You know, is there maybe, is a complex, obviously, is an education system. So obviously it's complex, a lot of factors in play. But when we're especially now here in this area about parents' rights and responsibilities, is there something you would recommend to policymakers? Would you have a suggestion?
I think one simple thing that can be done and something we have been advocating for a long time is disclosure by schools. So let schools self-disclose, right? What are the fee structures? Often it is not very clear to parents how fees get decided year after year, right? So there are quite a few concerns. It's not the private schools are perfect, right? And of course, no, many private schools are the kind that I would not send my child to. So there's huge scope for improvement even in those schools, right? So one is a disclosure. So I think legally they can be required to disclose certain items, and maybe they will disclose even more items when there's a pressure from the market competition, right? So helping the competition to do well and focus on what matters as opposed to just well-painted buildings, because you see competition happening along those lines, because that's what parents are able to see from outside and that's what they can see and understand, right? So I think you need to empower parents by helping them to focus on things that do matter. And we know that, yes, buildings matter, but other things matter even more in good education, right? So I think disclosure by schools, maybe it's even possible for government to collect information, because there's, of course, a lot of administrative data be collected by the government from all schools, right? And that can be sort of simplified and presented to parents that this is how your schools in the neighborhood are ranked or performed. They don't even have to rank them. Let's not create that kind of one single dimension of comparison across schools, because they're all very different kinds of schools. At least give information to parents about various parameters about the school that they can use in making their judgment and choices. Again, there's a research being done that shows that when you provide this kind of information in a way that parents can understand and digest and able to use, they do make those choices which are better informed than they otherwise would have made. So just like for any one of us, right, if you have better information, we would make also better choices. And the same applies to, obviously, for poor parents. So I think that information giving role, right, and thereby providing better choice, helping them to make better choices, is, I think, an important role a policy can make.
Great. Thank you, Parth. I've never felt more like an educated idiot than before by talking to you and hearing your stories of how these poor parents are actually, working towards really making sure that their children have access to quality education and in terms of the quality or a better life that they understand, which is still very, very much relevant to their circumstances rather than somebody looking from above and saying, this is what the education system should look like. So it's been a really, really good talk to, great pleasure to have you talking to us. Before we let you go, I really wanted, what are the key takeaways from this conversation that you would like our listeners to have? What are some of the things about the education system, especially in a liberal world, that we can imagine? What should be the key takeaways for designing a liberal education system?
I think one important, the one that we discussed just now, is the fact that difference between being educated and being wise in able to make choices, right? I think often we discount the judgment of the poor across many fields, not just in education, but also in healthcare particularly, right? It's not really wise on our part, right? Parents really have the most stake in making sure the children do have a better life, right? So we need to empower them and trust what judgment they are making. And often they will be different than what judgment we would make. I think in a liberal education system, liberal society, we must live with those differences, right? And make sure that the differences actually pan out well for all the parents, right? So I think that's my first sort of learning, having worked in this area, is to trust the poor's judgment as much as we trust our own judgment, right? I think second is information, which is important part. So disclosure on part of schools, making sure the government, civil society organizations, which work in the education space, create that information, help parents to understand how to make even better choices than they are making. I think third is what Rana already spoke about, is money should follow the child and not schools. So our campaign slogan was fund students, not schools, right? I think that's an important way to bring accountability in the system. It's also an important way to empower parents and also school owners and school service providers to offer different options, right? In India, we have a huge number of, huge variety of schools that one can choose from, right? And I think that's a very good thing for the system as a whole, for innovation, for doing the right thing for the parents and by the for the kids. So I think those are the sort of bigger, smaller things in some ways. There are many technical things one can talk about in terms of how you structure the school system. Much research has been done, as you know, on these issues about what makes a good education system. And we have some learnings also from India in terms of what could that be. But I think that's more technical. I think broadly, for a liberal education system, we just need to figure out how to trust and how to empower those parents to make those choices.
Great. Thank you so much, Parth, for your time and sharing your experience and knowledge with us. We really had a very, very fascinating discussion. And yeah, we're really, really grateful.
Thank you for having me. It's been lovely conversation.
Thank you, Parth.
Thank you.
Wow, Peter, that was an interesting conversation with both Michael and Parth. My head is spinning with so many thoughts. We had all these different elements that are part of the liberal education system, and each and every part, of course, we could go into far more depth, but I think we got a couple of good messages coming out of all these five parts. So maybe we should just reflect a little bit, I would suggest. Let's do that, you know, let's have a quick look at what are these messages that we believe should really summarize what we discussed in this episode. Arpita, why don't you go and start?
For me, I think what struck me the most was when Michael presented this idea of rethinking education and putting the child at the center instead of some kind of a standardization, straight list, you know, system. But I also see the challenges in that. Say, for example, it's a poor country, you have a huge population that's entering the education system. Is this more cost effective? Is it more costly to dedicate resources? Because that approach is very much based on mentoring. It is a one-on-one attention that children require. And we just this discussion that we had with Parth on, you know, how poor parents value certain things that perhaps, you know, when we are looking at it from a different perspective, we necessarily do not recognize. But so I think one of the first key takeaways is definitely, can we design a better education system or a liberal education system is one that puts the kid at the center. The child is at the center. And how can we design an education system that fosters that child's skills, their initiative, you know, brings out the best in them? So I think that is a key takeaway for me. One of the key takeaways. What about you?
I would agree. I think that must lie at the heart of a liberal education system focused on the individual. And so looking at the second principle of a liberal education system, I think everybody agrees, and I do believe also Michael and Parth, even though we didn't ask specifically, but universal access must be part of an education system. It must be possible that every child has a chance and as an opportunity. So that must be a part of every education system. But I believe the liberal one would put slightly more emphasis on making sure there is a merit-based progression track. That's why we spent quite a bit of time with Michael discussing this in particular. But in a way, with Parth, it also came up, maybe not just as explicit as with Michael. And here, again, it brings it back to the point, what does the child want and what does the child really bring with him or her in the education process? So we learned from Michael, I thought, an interesting lesson that says, yes, a merit-based progression track is good, but if this is defined for everyone the same way, then we are not really valuing the individuality of all the children. So the question is not so much whether we should have a merit-based system. The question is, how do we define the merits? And how do we ensure, again, that we nurture individual talents of the children so that they can progress along the lines that they are good at and that they would like to progress. I thought that for me was such a strong message coming out of this conversation.
That's true. And also with regards to, because it all ties up, right? All these principles that we've been talking about sort of tie up with each other. Because if we think of an education system that allows this choice to parents of saying, my kid is different and this, you know, my kid requires this special type of school, which means that we should also have the space to allow different kind of ownership structures. Why should certain ownership structures be looked at with suspicion of some kind? You know, why this obsession with every child should be educated exactly the same way when we recognize that each child is special and different, has different abilities? So, you know, allowing parents that choice in terms of having different set of actors. Yes, we can have government schools with certain standardized education, but also allowing private actors. And I think India's case is so fascinating because James Tooley's research, to a large extent, also shows that these low-cost private schools also exist in the continent of Africa and are thriving in Africa. So it shows us that private doesn't necessarily, perhaps in Western parlance or in the educated parlance, translate to high-cost education. It can be low cost and it caters to a certain category of people who have perhaps different educational choices than what, you know, educated people sit and think are, you know, great, fantastic educational choices. So I think allowing parents that choice for them to guide, you know, how they want to see their children educated, but that means opening up the market to all these different choices to exist within the education system, I think, really fulfills another very, very important part of a liberal education system, which is celebration of diversity. It is one of our core principles. So I think if we want more diversity, I think one of my key takeaways was also saying, like, let's offer these choices. That means there needs to be multiple actors in the market.
And this, even, Apita, is such a good point, would take us to areas where we would really hesitate whether we really want to give people that choice or schools that choice. And that would be when they teach religious aspects we're not really agreeing with, when they teach in languages which we believe are should not be the medium of instruction, when they make choices that we do not agree with. As usual, diversity thrives only if we agree to choices that we don't agree with normally, versus if we're already agreeable, then who needs, you know, the freedom? Then basically there is no diversity anyway. So the question is how we can really give schools the autonomy. How can we trust them that they do the best for the children? And obviously, you know, how do we make sure the children actually follow the path that enables them to lead a more prosperous life in the future, or a more fulfilled life in the future, whatever is the objective of the child and the family of this school education. So school autonomy is a contentious matter again, and that's where we interestingly can draw the line. So, you know, a school system would just make sure everybody has access to school education. But a liberal one would say, we give and we trust the schools to actually do something that is helping the community, that is closer to what the community needs. It's closer to what the parents need. And indeed, it's all about choice and trust. And I think that's a strong message that we received at the end from PATH. Don't you think so?
Yeah, I agree. And just in terms of, I think the brilliant takeaway from PARS is just about realizing that poor people, there's a difference between education and wisdom. So parental rights and responsibilities means, I think, because poor people are spending a larger portion of their income in private education compared to rich parents who send their kids to private school, just in terms of the portion of their income, proportionally, they're more worried about what they're getting, what their kids are learning, which means there is a community oversight. They can fulfill that parental responsibility, and it's trusting that decision. So parental responsibility and rights does not just come because you're educated and you think you have the best way of like the, you know, the advancement in pedagogical methods, so on and so forth. You've researched, you can read Science Direct and like, you know, you've researched all of this and you can give access and explain to your kid what it's about. But it's also about trusting, you know, parents who are perhaps illiterate, but are making fantastic choices, which very much compared to your own, apparently, given the research that backs this up. So I think like that was a key takeaway of in terms of parental rights and responsibilities. I do think that the, you know, it ties up with school autonomy to a large extent, that as long as the school is within the community also has some oversight, and it's a natural oversight responsibility that the community takes over because their kids are going to that school. And so I think we can trust the community to make those choices, you know, properly, and parental rights and responsibilities to be fulfilled in that sense. Again, not necessarily choices that we might always agree with or like, in that sense, right? So again, it might be about religious teachings. It might be about some ideas that we think are wacky, whatever it is. If the community sees the importance of perpetuating those ideas, I think to a large extent, to allow that autonomy is a very good thing. Also, eventually, I think, you know, the community learning gets adapted, because if your kids graduates from school and does not find the opportunities that your parents, the parents thought that they would eventually, that means they will readjust their value system. So I think that was another very important takeaway for me.
And I also loved when Parth was making it so clear that this requires what he said, what he calls the environment of choice. So if you give the parents a right, but the schools have no autonomy and no right, then basically the parental right is worth nothing. So it can only work if you want the parents to exercise their rights and responsibilities. It can only work if the schools and the teachers also have their rights to actually adjust the curriculum accordingly, because otherwise there's no point for parents to actually explain what they experience. Well, this brings our episode on the liberal education system to an end. It has been a great pleasure for Arpita and me to discuss this with our guest speakers. The episode here comes as a part of the IAF podcast series that accompanies regular seminar programs at the location of the International Academy for Leadership in Gummersbach in Germany. Arpita, it was great talking to the guests today together with you and to our guests. And to our guests, feel free to join our other episodes and our discussions either at the Academy or on its various social media channels. Goodbye for now.
Bye-bye.